Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me this week is, of course, Jeremy Goldkorn, the man behind the indispensable Danwei.com. Great to see you, Jeremy.
Hi, Kaiser. Welcome back.
Hey, yeah, thanks for filling in for me last week. Also with us today is Will Moss, eminent spin doctor and blogger behind ImageThief.com. How are you, Will?
Hi, Kaiser. Good to be back.
And we've got two great journalists joining us today. Barbara Demick of Los Angeles Times. Welcome back to Cynica, Barbara.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Barbara, by the way, was nominated, in case you missed it somehow, for the National Book Award for her book about North Korea, Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea. She's also got a book on Sarajevo, on Bosnia, being re-released in April. It's titled Besieged. It's about life in time of war in the city of Sarajevo. And joining us for the first time on our show is Sharon Lafreniere of the New York Times. Great to have you here.
Good to be here.
I need to point out, though, that you have this delightful son, Brett, who interned with me in the summer of 2010 at Baidu, and he was just such a joy to be around, and I really thank you for producing such a fine young man.
Great. Take all the credit.
Today, we are going to be looking at two topics. First, we'll look at the food safety issues that have plagued China in recent years. Chemicals like melamine, added to milk to boost apparent protein content, and clenbuterol, a steroid that's fed to pigs to hasten muscle growth and reduce fat, are now household words now to anyone in China who hasn't been living in a cave. There's a frightfully long litany of food-related scandals that have focused popular rage on a government that seems unable to really effectively curb the kind of corner-cutting that's putting lives at risk in a country where people still ordinarily greet each other with, "Have you eaten yet?" in Chulamail. We are lucky to have Sharon and Barbara here, as they've both written pretty extensively about food safety related issues here in China for their respective papers. Next, we're going to talk about the apparent cancellation of Supergirls, Chao Jun Yusheng, which is a wildly popular American Idol type reality talent show, I guess. What do we call these shows, Will?
Yeah, a reality show. A reality talent show is good.
Right.
I mean, you know, dreadful would be something else I would call them. That's just me.
I don't think it's always bad. Anyway, I have a soft spot for a nice sound.
We'll talk about that later.
Anyway, it had been showing on one of China's most daring provincial satellite networks, Hunan Satellite Television. But let's jump right in and start our discussion on the food safety issue. Gutter oil, exploding watermelons, fake eggs. It seems like there's a new food-related scandal every couple of weeks here in China, and some of the more prominent scandals have actually brought down major food companies like Sanlu, of course, in 2008, and more recently have really severely impacted Shineway, which is a major producer of ham, sausages, and the like. And
because nothing ever went wrong with sausage.
No. Jeremy, you folks over at Danwei have covered this story really from the beginning, right? Maybe you could sort of give us a quick recap.
Well, we've produced a top 11 of recent food scandals, the top hits in the dodgy food charts. So April 2011, restaurants found to be using something called beef extract to turn pork into something that looked like beef. A little earlier in the year, also really reported on extensively in April, lean meat powder pork, which is the
clenbuterol.
Which is a substance basically used to, athletes also use it to develop muscle, but it has various side effects that are not too beneficial to people's health. Gutter oil has been a constant problem for several years already, but came to...
Let's explain what gutter oil is.
Basically, it's restaurants, gutter oil collectors go to restaurants and take the oil, the used oil, and sometimes even take it from the drains and sewers, apparently. And then they process it and resell it to restaurants, and it's cheaper than buying oil from regular sources. Also not very good for you. Exploding watermelons, May this year. These were watermelons that were injected with something that I think is called 4-chlorofenuron, which is a growth accelerator. But some of these watermelons then exploded. Melamine in the milk, obviously the big scandal was in 2008. It was hushed up during the Olympic Games and then exploded almost immediately after the Games. And it's a problem that has not been eliminated entirely, it seems. This is dairies using melamine to fake a high protein count in the milk so that they can dilute the milk with water and use melamine instead of having high quality milk. Another scandal from August this year, yard-long beans, long green beans, drenched in pesticide, pesticide whose name I think is isocarbofos, or isocarbophosphate. And this came to light in Wuhan in March 2010, reported a little late in the year. Then we have the artificial flavored steamed buns, baozi, using an artificial flavorant that is apparently carcinogenic, also this year. In February this year, rice tainted with cadmium, a study by Pan Xinggen, a researcher from Nanjing Agricultural University, found 10 to 60% of the rice sold in markets in six regions contained cadmium, a heavy metal associated with high blood pressure. After that, poisonous bean sprouts. April as well. It seems April was a bad month. In Shenyang, chemicals including urea, which is often used in fertilizers, and enrofloxacin, an antibiotic, were found. They'd treated bean sprouts with them. We had dyed steamed buns. Those are manto, those big steamed breads that had been dyed to make them look more attractive, using a banned substance, a substance not permissible to use in foodstuffs. Fake gourmet rice. This one is from 2010. Artificial fragrances found in rice from Wuchang in Heilongjiang province. Paraffin wax had been previously found added to old rice to pass for fresh rice. So that's a little summary of food scandals over the last year or so.
Is that all you got?
No, there's more.
Yeah, I could add a few more to that list.
I think he's set the stage. Thank you.
Yeah, I think he has. Sharon, what is the root of this problem? What's causing all these food producers to cut corners and presumably costs? And why is regulatory oversight just so damn difficult?
I think what the experts would say is that the food industry has exploded over the past two decades, but there's just a very rudimentary system of regulation. So there's about 500,000 food producers, but 4/5 of them have 10 or fewer workers. And
so it's just too fragmented.
It's way too fragmented, and there aren't enough inspectors. I think the one estimate was one food safety inspector for every 10,000 people, and they don't have a system for how do you actually regulate food. Like pork accounts for 2/3 of the meat that ordinary Chinese eat. Yeah, but only half of it goes through the slaughterhouses that are inspected. The rest of it is slaughtered outside slaughterhouses. So that's a really scary statistic. And the oversight is totally fragmented, where the Commerce Ministry is responsible for pork, but beef and poultry falls under agriculture. And most importantly, I think the experts would say there isn't a system for identifying where the problems are. They're still relying on this very antiquated system of random testing, where it's up to the inspector to take some samples and then prove that that's dangerous, even though everyone agrees that that's no way to go about it, instead of forcing the producers to show the inspectors that their production process is safe. So it's working in reverse of how it should.
So the SFDA is just terribly, terribly understaffed.
Understaffed, and it brings up a more important question, I think, in that you can see certain agencies here work with kind of machine-like efficiency, like the security apparatus, and then you see agencies like this that are like the WHO expert said, they're working like headless chickens. They're just running around doing raids sort of randomly and then saying, oh, we've arrested, 20 people for this, but they don't seem to ever get a grip on what the real problems are, like melamine, which was a problem in 2008, 300,000 kids sick, 6 infants died at least. Melamine is still a problem this year.
Yeah.
It's still being produced. And clenbuterol in pork, which is quite dangerous, still a problem over and over. Nitrate in meat, it's the same problems that they are not getting a grip on. But they have made some progress. They have passed a food safety law. That was 2009. They're trying to develop standards, but they have a long, long way
long
to go.
Long to catch up.
Yep, right. And they don't have enough people.
I mean, and if you dig even deeper, I mean, this is an intensely competitive market, right?
Very cutthroat.
There's a lot of pressure to cut corners.
Yep, especially with inflation.
Right.
But I do think that people's expectations are changing. They're no longer willing to you know, suffer the same risk to health and safety that they have. They're like, okay, government, you've proved, you know, you can do development. Now we have 500,000 food producers. Now give us safe food.
And so, Barbara, how would you characterize, I mean, as these scandals have proliferated, how has officialdom reacted to it? What have they tried to do? Have you seen them take any sort of meaningful measures or make any meaningful progress? Do they take it seriously enough?
They take it seriously, but their usual way of addressing it is through a campaign, big character posters, safe food now, you know, report food safety corruption, all these slogans and not enough real action.
It's cosmetic.
There's actually a campaign underway now, actually, if you all the restaurants have posters in them, you know, with a big fist smashing down on adulterated food and additives.
And that does exactly what for us?
Very little, I would imagine.
Right.
But I think that is the typical Chinese approach is a campaign rather than sustained action. And this has been an interesting year because you have also record inflation in China. So that puts pressure.
Much of it in food,
especially pork. And so it puts a lot of pressure on the food producers to keep the prices down. And I think the government, on the one hand, wants to ensure food safety because these issues are very explosive. And we saw with the melamine, it became a political issue where parents whose children got sick were out protesting and being arrested, and there was censorship. It very quickly goes political. On the other hand, the government wants there to be enough cheap food. They don't want inflation to become
like 40 kwai for a bandine of pork is a price at which most will not fork.
Very good, very good. Yeah, I saw a box of Cheerios today for 60 kwai.
That's just Jenny Lou's.
Things are going up.
Yes,
you know, the currency is going up here. The dollar is going down, imports are more and more expensive. So you create this vise that makes for a very ripe climate.
China semi-famously has a strategic pork reserve, right? And they've tapped into it a couple of times recently to try to level the prices, I think.
And how many countries have a strategic pork reserve? Amazing.
Maybe the only one.
What's the way forward here? I mean, how does anyone see any way for the situation to actually, you know, markedly improve? Is there any optimism among the experts that either of you, Sharon or Barbara, talked to in reporting your stories?
I think that what I've been told is that the government is getting more serious about it, and it's just their steps are too much baby steps. They're moving too slowly, and they're trying to create a framework. It's not like the system is broken. It's like there was no system. So first you've got to create a system.
And presumably this is something around which a lot of popular anger could congeal. I mean, this is such a basic. I mean, this is something that impacts everyone. It's not, you know, like some human rights issue that only touches, you know, a few people. This could have the potential to mobilize everyone.
This is your kids and your babies,
exactly.
And people get really riled up about it. And the minute there's a rumor about food poisoning, this issue with the tainted buns in Shanghai was, you know, sort of an explosive street issue. You know, everybody was up in arms about the buns being tainted. This makes people angry.
Yes.
And certainly the public is much more aware.
And what, Jeremy, what are you seeing? I mean, do you think that this is an issue that is dominating the Weibo waves?
I wouldn't say it's dominating, but it's ever present, not only on Weibo, but also things you hear that, you know, so-called middle classes are talking about. I mean, it's now a... it's a worry of everybody who has a child, and that's quite new, I think. And people's attitude are very much that, you know, if the government can get rid of all media coverage of the Wenzhou train crash, why can't they clean up the pork?
Yeah. Well, one sign of progress, though, is that Shanghai bun scandal was actually revealed by CCTV. They sent in undercover reporters who got into this filthy workshop and basically exposed it. So, you know, there's pressure from the media, even the government-controlled media.
Yeah, and the swill oil scandal was also exposed by...
By CCTV.
I think it was Hunan Television, wasn't it?
Well,
we'll be talking more about Hunan Television.
So, but the reporter who broke that story was just murdered, although they say it's
the police said it was a robbery. It wasn't anything to do with...
So, Will, as our resident spin doctor, how do you feel like government efforts to mollify public anger of this have played? I mean, I know that at least with the San Liu scandal, heads rolled.
Well, Zhang Xiaoyu's head literally rolled. At the time the head of the State Food and Drug Administration, and shortly after the melamine scandals broke, he was prosecuted and later executed. That was for corruption, and I think largely revolving around pharmaceutical companies, but it was still a highly symbolic rolling of heads. But I think the problem from a public perception point of view is that it seems like there's almost no trust left in any part of the system. You know, it's small companies and restaurants have been tarred. Big brands, the dairies, Shineway, these are major companies are getting tarred. And people are ready to believe the worst of the food industry very, very easily. And we've seen the consequences of that in things like the black PR scandal between the two dairies, Ely and Mengyo, where, they were planting negative stories about each other and,
just exploiting the fact that people are willing to believe the worst, that you're going to grow breasts if you drink Mengyo.
Right. So there's very little trust in the system, I think, and that makes people very anxious. And it makes people looking for a solution, and I don't think one has been forthcoming. And I don't think the government has been tremendously effective in giving people a sense of security, and possibly to some degree the opposite. The story of the government having its own secure food sources comes to mind.
Which I want to segue to. Barbara, while the average shoppers now have to fret about the pork that they buy, the dairy products that they consume, even the meals they eat in restaurants, the elites, particularly political elites, still have access to reliably safe food. You've written about this. It was a great piece that you put out earlier this week. I imagine all of us have read it. Tell us about these elite organic farms, the Tegung.
This is a very funny situation. It goes back maybe to imperial times originally, but in its modern incarnation began under the communists when, in a time of great famine, they wanted the officials to have enough to eat. And they began raising their own food Mao Zedong had his private food and other members of the leadership. And the issue was an abundance of food, but also safe food. So you had these private farms, and they would be assigned to different state-owned enterprises or to the Donwei, the work units.
Not
Jeremy's Donway, although I hope they produce
their
own.
They eat terribly.
Food. Yeah, yeah.
No, we have good organic food from Great Wall Fresh.
Flag. So you've got this whole system of private farms, and people who are at least a mid-level cadre will still get their food grown from one of these farms. And the farm that we wrote about, which is leased essentially to the customs bureau, is for their cafeterias, their higher level cafeterias. Mm-hmm. And we watched the big cars driving up and bringing out bundles of food. It was interesting talking to some of the neighbors around that farm because nobody's ever been inside. But organic farms are very secretive in that way. They're not for the public, and there's a very limited supply of public organic food.
But public organic food is becoming more popular. I mean, I do see it all over
the place. There's emerging organic food in public organic food industry. Here.
There's actually an organic farmer's market that roams. I think a couple of weekends ago it was over at Yuanli, and then.
But it's expensive.
Sure.
In a time when there is already food inflation, and I think it's rare, and it has not been entirely free of scandal as well.
One of the big supermarkets, Walmart,
that's right, was caught out recently selling ostensibly organic pork that turned out to be not so organic. Pork again seems to come up.
Some of the supermarkets, the Olay supermarkets, have an organic section. But the food is expensive. I went to one of these organic markets in the Central Park apartment complex, one of the more expensive apartments of the elite, also many foreign press.
Like half our friends live there.
And it was interesting. I was there at lunchtime, and a lot of women who work in the offices were coming in and looking at the prices. And I heard the same thing like 4 or 5 times, is I really should buy this for my family, but I can't afford it. They were all young moms.
So, you know, the rich have pretty much always eaten better. It's true in the U.S. as well. The rich eat much more nutritiously than the poor do because, you know, good wholesome food turns out, unfortunately, to be more expensive.
Will's wife, by the way, is a nutritionist.
Nutritionist. Yeah, so you can find her at nutritioneer.net or at nutritioneer on Twitter. That's my plug, Jeremy.
Okay.
But, you know, so the rich have always eaten better, and that's going to be true here as well. I think, you know, if I was the government, and I'm not, just in case anybody's unclear on that, but if I were the government, the thing that would worry me is I think for a lot of the – you know, the great stretch of the Chinese population, it seems like increasingly it looks like there's no option that they can trust. You know, if they can't afford organic food and they're losing trust in all these different aspects of the system or it's running very thin, you know, where do they go? And I think that becomes a tremendous source of anxiety and potential outrage, mm-hmm. particularly because it is families and it is children, classic catalyst for real outrage.
So speaking of outrage, I mean, have these organic farms, especially for the elite, these Togung farms, has their existence become widely known and has it become a focus of popular anger?
It has. Southern Metropolis did a piece about it earlier this year, and it got a tremendous reaction. People were really angry. In fact, I think much angrier than Americans would be in the same situation. I mean, when I first looked at it, I thought, well, you know, so there's organic farms and rich people buy better food. But to the Lao Bai Xing who can't afford this stuff, it is an outrage. And what's funny is these farms are quite secretive.
Mm-hmm,
you know, this before I knew much about this, a couple of years ago when I first came to China, we had an intern in our office who was writing a piece about organic farming. And this seemed like kind of a safe topic, mm-hmm. you know, it's non-controversial.
And is there such a thing?
Yeah, he said, you know, it's funny, I keep on calling these organic farms, and they say, oh, we can't talk, we're not allowed to comment. I thought, this is strange, but they're all very secretive because they don't have enough supply. I was talking to somebody who procures Togung special supply for one of the foreign schools, and they said, you know, you find a good organic farm and you don't tell anybody else about it.
Hmm. Well, so how are we all feeling? I mean, personally, at a personal level, when you're out there buying food, how is it affecting you in the choices that you make when you're in the grocery store?
I have to say it was really distressing for me to talk to the WHO expert and have him tell me, I have no idea where it's safe to buy food here.
Well, Sharon, you're pretty freaked by it.
I just think it's really disturbing because it's a basic of life,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And affects everyone. And you would think, you would think WHO would know, the food safety expert would know. And when he says, I have no idea, that's a complete crapshoot. It's distressing.
Great. I'm glad I'm on a diet right now.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we already have our special supply. We were talking about the prices at Jenny Lou's. A lot of us shop at foreign supermarkets with a lot of imported products. There was a while I was buying Australian milk and Australian butter, but if you're out in the countryside and you're buying stuff at a little supermarket,
you have no idea.
And I'm always shocked when I'm buying in the countryside. I bought a tin of fish not long ago. Actually, I hate to admit this, to feed to a cat, but we opened.
The cat died.
It's a long story, but I had bought a cat in Guangdong that I was rescuing from a soup kitchen. I don't want to get on to animal rights, but we opened the can this tin of fish, and there was just a bone in it. There was no meat. It was like a stripped bone. And I've had this experience of opening cans in China, and there's, you know, the product is not in this. I bought some juice for my son last weekend, and it was a brand name juice, but it was something else.
I mean, that's one of the food things that we hadn't talked about. Actually, a lot of the beverages nowadays are faked. I mean, there's a lot of counterfeit popular beverages. I mean, I've encountered them myself. I mean, wait, this tastes strong. This was
a packet of Capri Sun strawberry juice, and you know, we opened it and it wasn't strawberry juice, and you know, he spit it out immediately.
I mean, that's actually a problem, and that's interesting because, you know, classically what happens is that companies, you know, identify the opportunity, and you know, you could build a brand in China around, you know, safety and quality and reliability, but because it's so hard to control counterfeiting and copying, you know, I think it's still quite difficult to do that. And unfortunately, even the big brands that should be out front of doing that seem to have problems themselves, partially because the supply network is so fragmented and hard to control. And that was certainly the problem with the dairy industry. The problem was it was
small dairy
zillions and zillions of 5-cow dairy farms, you know, aggregating in several stages up to
the argument for big agriculture.
Well, look, big agriculture suffers from its problems too, and all you have to do is read about the food industry in the U.S. to see that. But there's definitely a balance someplace in the middle there.
And, well, one difference with the U.S. is there's no consumer organization here, right? So there's no one to speak for all these individuals who are wondering what's in what they're eating and what
and
they're
And those drinking. That do speak for them get locked up, like Jolyon Hai, who was one of the melamine milk activists.
Right.
Is this going to be a focus for civil society, though, like environmental issues, like...
I think it very much could be. And I mean, I think it would take one big food safety scandal.
Like, we haven't had enough of that. One more.
But a really big one, you know, one that caused some fatalities. And it could make a very, very big problem in China.
Sooner or later, it will happen.
Well, anyway, on that, let's leave this utterly depressing topic behind us and move on to something more frivolous. Supergirls. Earlier this week, the State Administration of Radio, Film, and Television, or SARFT, informed Hunan Satellite Television that its wildly popular vocal talent show Supergirls would not air next year, and that instead, quote, the channel will air programs that promote moral ethics and public safety and provide practical information for housework.
Sounds like must-see TV.
Absolutely. I'm there. SARFT's cancellation of this popular show has spawned an awful lot of speculation as to why it's been canceled, with some guessing that it was, you know, Beijing nervous about, you know, a popular show employing democratic voting mechanisms. Others, like our own Jeremy Goldhorn here, telling Tony Brannigan at The Guardian that he thinks it's about clamping down on an uppity provincial station.
That's right, but I mean, not because it's uppity, but because it's stealing, getting viewers from CCTV.
Right.
And I'm, you know, there was similar speculation in 2006. If I may just present a quick review of the history of Supergirl.
You
are a resident popular culture story. Supergirls,
it started in 2004 on Hunan Satellite, which is probably the most entertaining and interesting TV station in China. And the 2005...
Low bar, by the way, that's a very...
That is a very low bar. The 2005 season was a huge hit in China. That was the season that made Liu Chun, whose fans are unfortunately called Yumi, which, you know, for a long time people asked me if I was a fan of Liu Chun because of my Chinese name, Jin Yumi. But that year, there were frenzied crowds of mostly teenage girls, but
all sporting the same androgynous haircut, right?
Many of them sporting androgynous haircuts and forming clubs. And it was almost like a cult. There were four finalists who each had... followers probably in their millions. So after the 2005 season, Liu Chun went on to become a big star and still is. In 2006...
Actually, all of them did.
All those
four finalists did.
That's true, they all did. In 2006, SARFT once again clamped down on Hunan TV, and they issued various orders, directives, saying that the hosts couldn't mock or harass the contestants. All contestants must be above 18 years old, restricting hairstyles and sexy clothing, etc., etc. And there were some attack dogs, such as a Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference member, Liu Zhongde, attacking the Supergirls as a terrible moral blight on Chinese society. Very, very similar to what's going on now. At the same time, CCTV launched its own
On Channel 3, right?
Show that was a clone, basically, of, well, Supergirls was a clone of American Idol, but it was exactly the same format. So that led me to suspect at the time that it was very much a turf war, and CCTV didn't want this uppity provincial station to do better than it in the rankings.
I hear they do that even with you know, search engines.
Search engines. They do next time. But CCTV and SAFT are, I think, you know, a much more powerful combination than MIIT and the People's Daily's lousy search engine.
Talk a little bit more about what a cultural phenomenon this thing became. I mean, it contributed a lot of language to. I mean, we were you know, suddenly using words. PK,
you know, so that's player kill, which actually came from video games, Supergirl's popularized it to mean, you know, when two people or two opponents have a fight to the death. Even the word, the Chinese word that's so popular now for fans, fansi, I think really entered the mainstream lexicon with Supergirls.
And it also generated a whole bunch of debate about, you know, gender aesthetics, about... these androgynous hairstyles.
Because particularly Liu Chun was.
And she wasn't the only one. Right. She wasn't the only one. There were other contestants in subsequent years. Anyway, what do y'all think was the. What was the ostensible reason for the cancellation this year?
Over time.
Right, exactly. It was just.
By a few minutes, apparently.
Significantly, apparently. It was like 3 hours long.
No, but that was the first one. And then after that, they ran over a couple times, but only by a few minutes, they said.
And Sharon, that was enough for them to decide, okay, you won't stage this show next
but time. But it seemed like really a flimsy pretext. But yeah. The longer they went, the more audience they stole from CCTV. And what I was talking to a friend who's a filmmaker who thought very much as Jeremy.
Right,
this was turf war, that they were just too popular, they were taking too much market share, and they needed to be hammered back down.
Yeah, I mean that would be my take too. There are others. I think what do we make of this whole the democracy thing? People want to hang this idea on it. Will, do you have
I don't particularly buy the democracy argument. I think that's Westerners projecting their own ideas onto this situation. I mean, I do think that there are, you know, I think the government always has an eye on anything that looks like it can sort of motivate a large number of people. I do think the cultural concerns were real, though.
This was an expression of vulgar culture.
Yeah, it was vulgarity. I mean, that's something we've seen the government preoccupied with across many aspects of media in different times.
Like, Feichang Wurao is not, right?
That's the thing. The Feichang Wurao is the dating show that was perhaps most famous for, what was in it, Manor, the contestant who said she needed a rich man.
Yeah.
I would rather cry in the back of a BMW.
And they got into trouble very quickly.
Smile on the back of a bicycle. Yeah, they did get him in trouble. Right.
And you know, the television in particular, I think, is still very much seen by the authorities as needing to reflect very, very mainstream, by which I mean boring culture, and you know, not departing from the values that the government would like to see promulgated. I mean, the unfortunate side effect of that is that, as anybody who's watched any amount of Chinese television can tell you, it's pretty dull by and large.
Really?
Yeah, go figure. And I think there's another side effect of that as well, which is that, and you and I were talking about this before the podcast, but that I think what happens, though, is they end up chasing a lot of the edgy culture, you know, off of television, but onto the internet.
Right, onto these, you know, onto the Yokus and the Tudos of the world, right.
So in a sense, they're sort of squeezing the cultural water balloon. Rather than stamping this stuff out, I think they're pushing it from one medium to another.
Where it's less easily regulated, do you
suppose? Yeah, I think so. And, you know, they're preoccupied with culture on the internet as well, but manifestly that's, again, much less centralized and harder to manage.
Right. An interesting topic, but I think we're going to leave this and move on because we're running out of time here. And I want to move on to our recommendations for the week. We've got a fresh cast of faces here, so let's hear what everyone's got to recommend. Why don't we start with Sharon from the New York Times?
I would recommend The Temple, which is a new restaurant opening up, which kind of gives a feel of old Beijing, and you can walk around before dinner and check out the historic buildings. And then this restaurant is being opened soon by Simon Elegant.
Simon Elegant is the former bureau chief of Time magazine here. Great guy, really good guy. And also one of the main chefs from Maison Boulou. It does look great. And I think the restoration has been it's been minimal. They've kept all the old rafters up above. It's great. I think the aesthetic is terrific.
Yeah, just the venue is beautiful.
Where is it?
It's near the Meishu Guan. It's in central Beijing. on the west side of the art gallery.
It's not easy to find.
No, it's kind of tucked away, but it's worth looking
that's the,
for.
I think, part of the charm.
We have no doubt that they will vet all their ingredients fastidiously.
Yeah. I should hope so. Right. Let's move on. Barbara, what you got for us?
Well, I just finished reading, besides Dickens, Kaiser and I have been going back and forth on Charles Dickens, as you recall, but I did just finish reading a great book called Midnight in Beijing.
Midnight in Peking.
Paul French. Yeah. And it's a true life, true crime story about a young woman who's murdered in the 1930s. Just before the Japanese occupation, and it just is a great book at evoking this lifestyle of the decadent expatriates at a certain period.
Like us.
Yeah, at a certain period of Beijing. So I found it quite interesting, and it happened.
Paul French is a very talented writer.
Yeah, very close to where I'm living.
Oh, really? Where is it set?
Just to the east of the Legation Quarter, where it was apparently a red light district.
Yeah, it was a very famous red light district during the Qing Dynasty.
Maybe you know Kaiser.
I only know historical red light district.
But it's really a good read.
Paul French, Midnight in Peking.
Good whodunit.
Will, what you got for us?
I'm going to recommend two specific blog posts or online articles that I think are worth reading. One has been out for a few days, and one was new as of today. The one that's been out for a few days is David Bandersky's post on the China Media Project from Hong Kong University on what happened at the Beijing News, which is one of the clearest and most lucid explanations of how the ownership structures of Chinese media are arranged as a mechanism of control. So
I'm wondering if we have ever had a Seneca podcast where David Bandersky is not mentioned.
Yes, we have, but he has come up a few times.
I love the guy's work. Absolutely love his work.
So that post is well worth reading for anybody who kind of wants to understand the relationship between government and media. So it's called What Happened at the Beijing News? Just Google China Media Project and What Happened at the Beijing News. You'll find it. And the other thing was a slide share that went up today from the blog China Youthology, comparing China's online and offline youth and how they're different culturally and behaviorally.
Oh, that must be very interesting.
And it's a sort of marketing oriented, but is an analysis of the online culture and its relationship with offline culture. Pretty interesting. So that's China Youthology, spelled like it sounds. And it was posted today, today being the 22nd, on China's online youth versus offline youth, with a heavy focus on microblogging.
Cool. Jeremy, what you got for us?
All right, I got two things because I didn't have a recommendation last week. One is the thing I mentioned already, greatwoolfresh.com, some peasant farmer buddies of mine who run a genuinely organic farm. And
nice,
you can go hiking hiking on the Great Wall, but it's real organic food.
I've been there. I'll vouch for it. It's awesome.
And the second thing is something where tomorrow we'll have a video on Dunway.com about, but it's connected to Beijing Design Week, which is going on starting Saturday. And on Saturday, September the 24th, just south of Tianmen at the Northern Electric Relay Factory, there will be an exhibition. One of the exhibitors is an artist named Nicholas Hanna that we shot a video about. And what he did was he's a sort of multimedia artist. He took a Beijing-style tricycle, and on the back he put these big bottles of water and a computer-controlled system so that he can type characters, Chinese characters, into a computer. And then this, as he cycles along on this tricycle, it does water calligraphy. Sort of looks like a dot matrix printer rather than proper calligraphy.
Wow.
But it's just the wackiest project you've ever heard
and
of.
We can see this online somewhere?
It'll be online on Dunway.com tomorrow. You're in Beijing, you could go to Tianmen on Saturday at 6 p.m. where the exhibition opens.
Wow, that sounds fabulous. I definitely want to check that out. What I'm going to do today is less of a plug, maybe for an entire oeuvre of work, but for a guy who I've known for an awfully long time, and I have every reason to dislike because, you know, he dated my sister and then married my ex-girlfriend, and now he's won a MacArthur Genius Grant, and his name is Peter Hessler, and he's everybody's favorite China writer. I adore the guy. He's a terrific, terrific writer. There's a new piece in The New Yorker. He's been living in southeastern Colorado for... Southwestern? I don't know. So anyway, in Colorado. And did this great piece in The New Yorker about a rural far, far, pharmacist, a druggist, really get completely non-China related, but his whole body of China related work, the trio that he did, Rivertown, Oracle Bones, and Country Driving, are all books that I'm sure have been recommended to you a few times, but do read them. Pete's a great guy, and congratulations to him for winning the competition. Bastard on top of it. Okay, hey, thanks to you guys for coming. Sharon, Barbara, Will, Jeremy, for joining me on the Cynical Podcast, and we will see you next week. Take care.
Thanks.